Good morning and welcome to the April 3rd, 2017 meeting of the Chelan County Public Utility District Commission meeting. I'd like to remind everyone to please silence your cell phones and any other electronic devices that you may have brought with you today. Today's meeting is a study and business session, with the study session starting this morning at 10 a.m. and the afternoon business session beginning at 1 p.m. We welcome the public's input today at all of our meetings, and since these meetings are recorded, if you wish to address any item on the agenda, we ask that you come to the microphone by Sheila and speak. Please state your name, address for the record. Additionally, we have a nice crowd here today, and in order to keep our agenda on track, please limit your comments to 3 minutes and allow others in the audience the opportunity to speak before you comment for a second time. Today we have a quorum with three commissioners being present. Commissioner Smith and Commissioner Bowles have both been excused. All of the customary staff members are here today, including General Manager Steve Wright, General Counsel Eric Walquist, and Clerk of the Board Sheila Salmon. As is always our tradition, we will start our meeting today with a Pledge of Allegiance and a Safety Minute led by Y. Peterson.
I pledge allegiance
to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Well, I wanted to share at least a safety deal, at least experience that I had. Had to relate to at least the season that we're in, along the lines of allergic reactions, in this case bees. So a little story, and I'll make it short. I went hiking with my family up lake years ago, and for me and my style, I like to just stay in behind just because it's clear of all the hazards and the bees and everything because I'm allergic. Well, in this case, we're walking along, and the group, this, you know, my brother who's right in front of me, I don't know if it was a rivalry thing or what, but he steps on a bee's nest, stirs it all up, and lucky me, I'm the next guy in line. So they all attacked me, and you know, I'm not the quickest guy, but I guarantee I probably ran a 4.240 that day. And the thing about me, I didn't have my EpiPen with me at that time, and I'm up lake, I don't have it, so pretty much after that incident, we went back home, and it took me out for a full 24 hours. I was in bed, my legs were all swollen up, it was hot, and it just zapped my energy. So for me, I learned quickly, I've got to have my EpiPen. So if you or somebody you know is allergic, get your EpiPen, make sure it's current because they expire. So that was a big thing for me. And also, you know, I'm talking with Dave here in safety, but, you know, I've got a little bee allergy sticker on my ID, even on my helmet. So if I'm out, something happens, people know. So something about that. The other moral of the story is, you know, obviously you have your EpiPen if you're allergic. The other one is when you go hiking, make sure you're the guy stepping on the nest, not the one taking
it. Oh, that's great. Thank you. And allergies, too. You can be perfectly fine and suddenly later in life develop an allergy to something that I've known someone who became allergic to shellfish at the age of 45 after eating lots of shellfish. So you're right. Yeah. Thank you.
Just wait a second. You can't get away this quick.
Yeah, come on back here. Go ahead. Well, I was just going to say, Y is modest. He's fibbing a little bit. He is the quickest guy. Mm-hmm. Steve and I have watched Y play basketball for about 13 years, and he is very quick, and enjoyed watching him play basketball, enjoyed growing up in the same community as Y. He's a great addition to the PUD, so welcome.
Thank you.
Yep.
And Y, I won't be quite as nice as Commissioner Condon, as your principal and superintendent for staff. If there's anybody that wants any dirt on Y-10, I'll come and tell me.
I was expecting that.
Actually, he's an amazing person. I'm glad you're with the PUD.
Well, thank you all. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Y. So, commissioners, we've been presented with an agenda, but before we get to the agenda, I just wanted to make a comment. I see some folks here from Lake Chelan that have had some concerns and interest about our substation. I just wanted to make note that the substation is not on our agenda today, And so just in case you would come down thinking that we might have it as an agenda item, it will not be on the agenda. Okay, thank you.
Gary, am I on? I think I'm on.
Yeah.
So I know Carolyn and Corky, and I know they're going to want to. Well, I think Corky drove this morning 3.5 hours, right, from the west side. So I think they're going to want to make some comments. At what point would you welcome their comments, questions?
Let's get to the point where we are through our wireless proof of concept, and I think that might be a good time to make some comments.
Or maybe staff, maybe Steve knows if we have staff prepared and to present.
It really at any time in the morning that you're comfortable with.
Yeah.
Why don't we put them up first? And
well, we can do that, and then that will free up your time, and you'll have the rest of the day. So let's go ahead and get approval for the agenda. So, commissioners, we have an agenda in front of us. What are your wishes?
So I would just suggest that we move Resolution 10, that's on the regular agenda, move that to the consent agenda.
Agree.
Yeah, agree. Okay, we will move item number 10 to the consent.
Sorry, yeah. So, commissioners, we do have one item that we need to add to the consent agenda related to a voucher payment approval. One of the bullets, you'll see the following, the vouchers on the back of the first page or page two, didn't make the agenda because it wasn't in on time. So we'd like to add that to the consent agenda voucher approval and payment approval section. But I think I could do it more clearly at the time.
Yes.
So that it's related in time.
Perfect. Good. Is that all right with all the commissioners?
Would we do that as a consent item since we haven't, I have no idea.
Well, so my preference would be that you would add it to the consent agenda prior to taking action on the consent agenda, yes.
And that'll be this afternoon in the business.
Correct.
Thank you, Eric. Okay. So we have an agenda. I'd like to, at this time, invite anyone who would like to speak with respect to the substation to have an opportunity to come forward.
Hello. Corky Thorson, 63 Balsam Drive in Chelan. I'll be brief. I sent a memo to Ann Congdon, I think 2 weeks ago or so, regarding undergrounding costs for the city of Kirkland and how they go about it. And the costs are inherently incurred by the developer and or builder, whether it's a single family or multifamily development. Now that brings us to our issue that we have up on the hill. I would really like to see some engineering and or excavation costs for transmission lines coming off the transmission line perpendicular from north of the T-box at number 14 on the Chelan Muni, heading directly down to Lookout with the idea of a substation being placed in Lookout. I don't know if you folks have approached them. I assume that you have, and maybe they said no, but being that Lookout and Crystal View are the prime drivers for the power demand in the valley, I don't see why something can't be arranged to provide for a small parcel of land for a substation down there. What that would do, 0.625 miles from the 14th tee down to Lookout, undergrounded, I know it can be done, a little bit more engineering required, maybe you don't have the equipment, but I'm sure PUD has it somewhere in the Pacific Northwest, and it could be transported up to this area to temporarily be used interdepartmentally. Now, with that being said, if that is done, that solves a lot of our problems. As far as distribution lines coming from there going to Crystal View, it could go up Boyd Road because I understand there's going to be a widening project on Boyd Road this year. If it went underground, it could go all the way up to the line that comes off my property at 63 Balsam and heads down to Crystal View. Those distribution lines, they could intersect at that point. and I think the problem would be solved. So I strongly suggest that PUD look at examining that, the idea of the engineering and or the excavation from the 14th tee box in that area down to Lookout, and I strongly suggest you advise the Lookout to consider selling you a piece of property down there. And one more thing, as far as visual blight, I understand some of these substations can be encased within a small building, if that would please more people. So that's basically what I have to say, and I hope you entertain and look at it as seriously. And yeah, that's all I got to say. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Courtney.
Before he sits down, I have
yes.
a question
yeah.
for Corky.
Yeah, you bet.
What is the project on Boyd Road that you said is?
I understand they're going to do
coming up.
Appreciate it.
I understand they're going to do a widening of the road
oh.
and put in new curbs to run stormwater off Boyd Road and do it so it doesn't wash out. It would be a prime time to be doing undergrounding up that way.
Thank you.
You bet. Thank
yeah.
you.
Commissioner, I might just take a second and say, in this interim period, what we're doing is just looking at options around the load center and thinking through what the implications are in terms of what distribution, transmission, and I do want to draw a distinction between distribution and transmission. Transmission is much more difficult to underground, much more expensive to underground. Just looking at what those options would be and trying to develop some cost estimates as well. So I think that's certainly within the realm of the work that we're trying to accomplish.
Thank you very much. Yeah, I appreciate that. And being the distance is, like I said, couldn't be more than 5/8 of a mile as a crow flies down to the Lookout. That would certainly curtail some of the costs. Yeah.
Thank you.
I'm going to do this right. Carolyn Glossinger, 490 Boyd Road. I always forget to get that all in. I want to thank you guys. I got that wonderful email from Tika at the end of the week about how you are going to proceed closer to the blue line, aware of the impacts to visual property. Thank you. That's it.
Thank you, Carolyn.
How nice that you came all the way down to give us a nice thank you. We appreciate it.
Thank you. Is there anyone else in the audience that would like to speak to the substations? Okay, well, thank you for coming today. Thank you for sharing. Hearing no additional substation comments, Steve, I'd like to turn the meeting over to you for introduction of agenda items.
Okay, next up, we're going to do a legislative update, and Sean Seaman will be presenting that for us.
Morning, Commissioner. Sean Seaman with External Affairs. This will be a quick update. You have a meeting coming up this week, so we'll get some more information, or next week, excuse me, from Waputa. Sorry to startle you there, Steve. You're like, I don't think we have a meeting this week. So a quick update. I won't hit on everything. I'm going to hit on some highlights, and if you have any questions, please let me know. So we've been talking the Centennial Grant funding. This is for the project, for the Peshastin Wastewater Plant project upgraded to deal with the phosphorus. The Senate capital budget included $35 million for this program, which is well within the amount of money that we are looking for. This is for the biennium. We need, right now, $2.1 million is 60% of the cost, so we'll stay with that 60%, and so we're still looking fine. The only project in front of us is a project that would be limited to $5 million. That's the limit for these programs, so we're looking very good right now from the Senate side. All indications are from the House budget that will come out this week as well in the next couple of days. Even though they can't tell us, it looks good that we'll have adequate funding in the House budget as well. So we're looking very strong for that grant funding. Jump down to distribution generation and distributed system planning. This is Representative Morris has had various bills out there, including continuing the solar incentives, distribution resource planning. He's actually has an EV, an electric vehicle component. And he is still working these, has work groups, may come up with an omnibus bill. He has managed to make this, at least the solar bill, NTIB, necessarily to implement the budget because it has a fiscal component. So we are still waiting to see what may come out of Representative Morris's committee on this. The state auditor issue for us was the unit price contracting bill. Number, you may remember number 5036. It has actually been moving well into its out of the House of Origin. Now it's in the Senate, or into the House now, excuse me. And it's scheduled for executive action tomorrow, and it's gone through with very strong support. So we're looking good. This would help address some issues we've had with unit price contracting with the state auditor. The pole attachments, wireless, and this includes the wireless equipment, 5G. The Senate Bill 5711 was the one from Senator Doug Erickson. It didn't make it out of its committee. They tried making it necessary to implement the budget. It did not show up in the Senate's budget, but that does not mean there's still not activity around this bill. And so we're continuing meetings with various stakeholders, including the governor's office, to ensure that our position is well known, that expansion of 5G is not related to pole attachments, and that message is now loud and clear. People are getting that. There's a new bill that's been just out by Senator Carlisle from Seattle to deal mainly with the city's issues and their preemptions that were being sought by the industry. And that's out in a conversation piece, as well as we have an indication that Senator Erickson has a new draft bill out that came out late Friday that could be considered for the special session. So remember, if we get into special session, all bills that were dead are back on the table again, and new bills can be introduced. So behooves us all to hope that we don't go into a special session this year. I'm going to jump down to Public Works Trust Fund on the page 3. The bill that's moving forward that has support of the Public Works Board right now is 1677. This became more of a, again, the term omnibus bill. They threw a few things in. It's trying to shore up the board itself to add some legislators to that. Right now, there are no legislators on the board, and having that would probably, the thought is that would help that board having that connection. This is a policy bill only. There's no fiscal components to it, but it is trying to address how the board would make loans, determine interest rates. And they've done that by separating projects that have rate bases of over $50,000, so the city of Wenatchee would be under that. Our water systems would be under that. Most of everything in Chelan County would be under that. And they have two different ways of calculating or at least helping set rates. Below $50,000, they've left it more open that they would determine the rates. They could provide grants. They have a lot more flexibility for projects that have a rate base under $50,000. It gives them some structure how they would determine interest rates on these loans or provide grants or other mechanisms. Other key issues, we've had a couple of HR, human resource related bills we've been tracking closely. 1116 is implementing the family medical leave bill. It's considered necessary to implement the budget, but it hasn't moved out of its original committee in the House. Its last action of this was February 24th, but there is a strong desire by some of the proponents to keep this bill alive. There's another one, 1298 is about asking prohibiting employers asking about arrest records, etc., ahead of through the application process. Component of that we want to understand is how would that impact driving records as well. So we're going to track that bill and see how that would work out into the future as that progresses. The carbon bills are still all active, likely going to be necessary to implement the budget. The only one that's really had much action, though, has been Fitzgibbon's bill, 1646. This is a bill that's also been promoted by the Alliance for Clean Jobs and Energy, and may become a subject of initiative in the future. That's their voicing of their position on this. The 5303 is the Aquatic Invasive Species. This is a bill that would provide Department of Fish and Wildlife funding to increase their monitoring inspection stations. That is Senator Huntingford's bill is starting to see some movement, which is good. It's also necessary to implement the budget. The last two, roadway worker safety. This is one that would just provide similar protection to like utility workers that are afforded to first responders as far as driving laws, infractions, etc. And the last one we've been tracking, the Voting Rights Act bill is now dead for the session. It did not make it through the last cutoff. Our next cutoff is Wednesday. It has fiscal committee bills, but again, those that are necessary to implement the budget will still be active throughout the end of the session. Happy to entertain any questions.
Commissioners, I want to just say on this Public Works Trust Fund, there have been a number of proposed substitutes over the last couple of years, none of which have been attractive to us, but this one actually is set up in a way that there would be value for us. And we've been encouraged by the local Public Works Trust Fund members to support it, and we are inclined to support this and believe that it would actually be helpful.
Does it have any wording on the legislate prohibiting the legislature from raiding or sweeping the funds?
Those are separate bills that they're working on to do that. There's a the Public Works Trust or the Public Works Board does have $100 million that's for their list of projects that's moving forward, so they would have their current list funded, and they are looking at other mechanisms to retain funding into the future, but not within this policy bill.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, Sean.
Next up, I'm going to invite Bob Shane, Mike Coleman to come up to talk about wireless proof of concept. Do a little bit of background here just for a moment. Recall that when we decided to get back into the business of expanding the fiber program as part of public power benefit, we concluded that we would shoot for getting to 85% to 90% of the county, and that the remaining amount we determined as just being too expensive at this point to be able to, too dispersed, too difficult to get to. And we went down the path of trying to explore a wireless proof of concept to see if it could be a feasible alternative for us. And so we've been at this for a couple of years now, and this is the final report on what's come out of the test program that we ran and where we want to go from here.
Good morning, Commissioners. Mike Coleman, Managing Director of Fiber and Telecommunications. I'm going to lead this off and let Bob Shane and Eleanor Liu cover the heart of it. Bob, of course, is the Director of Operations for Fiber and Telecom, and Eleanor Liu is the Senior Telecom Engineer that conducted this proof of concept. There is no board action requested today. We are going to ask your input towards the end of the presentation. So why are we here today? Following up on our 2015 strategic planning, we had an action item to continue to look for alternative technologies that could provide us a reasonable, cost-effective alternative to cover that last 8 to 10% of the county. And so with the wireless proof of concept, specifically we were reviewing the cost and the quality of service, comparing the wireless broadband to fiber for those areas that were deemed previously as too expensive to serve with fiber. And we're going to be asking for the board's guidance on our next steps. So, Bob?
Thank you, Mike. So what we will cover basically is looking at the fixed wireless technology for broadband application. I mentioned fixed because it's not the same as what you'd expect with a mobile service. We're looking at the operational cost and what we learned from the wireless proof of concept. In doing that, we're going to go over an example build of the Yenyap Valley where we applied the technology. But the big takeaway is on our conclusion is we feel that the wireless is not a good alternative to our fiber solution for offering broadband services to the customers here in Chelan County. We'll start out with some basic broadband basics. The FCC defines broadband as a download speeds of 25 megabits per second, with upload speeds up to 3 megabits per second. By contrast, the district's fiber system will have speeds up to a gigabit per second with the capability and capacity to go much higher. The typical wireless retail service provider advertises speeds up to 100 megabits per second. And just for clarity, cellular and the mobile environment, currently you'd see 5 to 12 megabits per second for what you have on your phone now. With 5G, suggesting speeds of 100 megabits per second, but in reality, probably 40 to 50 megabits per second. From the user's experience, it doesn't really matter how you deliver broadband service as long as that system provides adequate bandwidth. So whether it's fiber over broadband over fiber or a wireline type solution or wireless solution, doesn't really matter. What really matters is when that customer or the end user uses that service, does it meet the expectations? And they are different between the different types of applications, web browsing, email, different requirement that you'd have on a typical I'm sorry, be a little bit different than what you expect on a video type solution that requires a lot more bandwidth. So you talk about bandwidth demand expectations. Cisco predicts that the traffic will rise considerably for video, up to 82% by the year 2020. Right now, a lot of the video that consumers use is through their cellular phone, but in the in an area that has wireless capability, they will, you probably do it yourself, you'll switch to your local area network wireless connection instead of using cellular, which impacts broadband wireless. By comparison, services such as email and web browsing uses very minimal bandwidth compared to video that uses a tremendous amount of bandwidth. We talk about the difference between wireless and fiber. It's all about the signal quality. That is, the system's capability of providing a quality of service is dependent upon how good that signal gets between the active parts of the network. When you talk about the fiber system, we use fiber as a medium, which is a very controlled and predictable environment, where wireless uses the atmosphere, which is subject to interference. And that's one of the big reasons you have issues with overall performance on a wireless system. You have very similar cost drivers on the two different systems. Longer distances tend to cost more to implement. Lower population density areas, remote areas, you don't have the efficiency, the economy of scale. And the bandwidth requirements are demanding for both systems. Wireless is limited. Fiber has a very high bandwidth capability. When you think of wireless, you might, as an example, think of sound and or light travel. When you're in a room, you do have sound that can travel through the walls, but in doing so, it's attenuated and it's also muffled. Wireless systems have the same issues, if you will. The more barriers between the source and the receiver, it has to work harder, and you can have less signal quality. When we compare wireless to fiber, as I mentioned before, fiber has extremely high bandwidth capabilities, in many cases considered to be unlimited. In a deployment of what we have here in Chelan County, the fiber itself remains as a permanent installation. You're changing out the electronics on the end in order to get the bandwidth you would want to anticipate in the future. For a wireless system, you're changing out the entire system each time. You have to increase the capabilities of that system, and it can be several times. Fiber itself has a 30-year life expectancy and even longer on the outside plant, the cable itself. And fiber, compared to wireless, is immune to the typical interference issues that you have with a wireless system, static, lightning strikes, and things like that. We talk about the wireless network components. Basically, there's the access point. That's the point that the subscriber units talk with. You have the subscriber unit, which sits at the home or the business. You have the backhaul component, which connects the access points back to your main system to carry that traffic. You have a network management system, which manages the overall systems. And when you look at the impacts to performance of wireless network, again, distance is an issue. There's two components of the distance. One is between the subscriber unit and the access point. We have a diagram here to look at shortly. And then from the access point back to your central office where you allocate and aggregate all of your traffic. Wireless is also very susceptible to interference, obstructions, and that depends on the different technologies used on the wireless system. So you have a basic sample wireless network, just to bring attention to some of the components we spoke to. At the bottom left there, there's the home or the business. You have the subscriber unit. It connects to an access point, which is over wireless. An access point can connect back to your central office by wireless as a wireless backhaul, or it can connect back in using fiber, and that's on the upper left-hand section where we show that. Wireless deployment drivers. When we look at what drives the cost of a wireless system up, it's very similar to what you have on a wireless fiber system. That is, low density areas tend to be more expensive to build out. Longer distance means you have more plant or more equipment in order to reach those distances. Bandwidth demand is a big driver on cost of any system, whether it be fiber or wireless. The difference on the fiber is it has a lot of capacity. On the wireless, it's limited capacity. Obstructions is a bigger component for wireless systems for reasons we mentioned earlier. And the backhaul requirements for a wireless system can be substantial. That is, you may be putting in a lot of other similar type wireless systems to get that connectivity or use fiber. And we find that maintaining the end user expectation would be a challenge for a wireless system as the bandwidth demands continue to climb. Get into the proof of concept details of the wireless system. We chose the Manson area. We have a number of access points up there. The technology that we used was called the WiMAX. That was specifically picked because it's a leading edge technology. It's a resilient system, and it would be something we would consider deploying. And we did use fiber as a backhaul component in that specific location instead of using a wireless system. That particular area has water, valley, mountains, hills, very typical wireless environment that you'd have to deal with, and that's one of the reasons we picked that area.
So I'll get into some details of the result we got from the test. I'm just going to pause for a few seconds for you to take a look at the map before I start speaking. So on this map, where the three orange lines intersect is the location of the access point. It is on a water tank by the water in Manson. The push pins are the locations where we stop by doing testing with the subscriber unit. So the green push pins are the locations where we got speed more than 25 meg. The yellow push pins are the locations where we got speed under 25, but we were able to get links. And the red push pins are the locations that we were not able to get a wireless link to the water tank. So in general, you can see that the closer we are to the water tank, the better, higher speed we're able to get. But what is not obvious on the map is that when we were driving around, we purposely chose locations where good clearing with clear line of sight to the water tank. So otherwise, you will see lots of red push pins on this map. And if you know, I want to use some examples by the lakeshore. For example, there's Lake Chelan Yacht Club. That's a boat launch. And where my mouse is another boat launch. At both locations, we had really good clear line of sight. The location that has the slightly bigger green push pin, that's the place I took a photo. The top picture is the photo I took facing the water tank. You can see it's clear line of sight there. The bottom picture, the green push pin, again, is the location we did the testing. What I want to point out is that there are houses behind the trees. They are very close to the test location, but we wouldn't be able to get usable signal at the houses because they are blocked by the trees. So like Bob was talking about, in a wireless environment, obstructions are very important. Their locations can be very close to each other, but one can get good signal, good link, but the other one wouldn't be able to. So I'm just using boat launch as the example. It doesn't have to be boat launch. It can be any other places. We drove other places that's not by the water, but the same principle applies. On this map, we want to make illustration of impact of terrain on the coverage. So there's a little symbol that says a water tower. Again, that's where our access points are. And where there's a green overlay, that's the area that we will have wireless coverage. And the areas not covered by green is the area that we will not have wireless coverage. So it is quite interesting because this area we would think is relatively flat, but actually terrain has that impact on it. The red push pin is Mill Bay Casino parking lot. That's the air, we will not be able to have coverage there because it is blocked by the hill here in this green. This is a hill. On the next slide, we just added the elevation profile that will just show it better of the elevation. So the leftmost is the elevation of the water tower, and rightmost is the elevation of the Mill Bay Casino. And you can see that there's a hill here that blocks the signal from the water tank to this area. So if we want provide wireless coverage to this area, we would have to add access point and add backhaul to this area, which would increase the cost. And there's also interesting that there's a little knoll here that we won't have wireless coverage because there's a dip in the elevation. On this slide, we show the test results. The y-axis is the downlink speed, and the x-axis is the distance to the water tank. The red dots are the test results, and the black curve is the curve that fitting these test results, which it shows that it follows the physical law, which is the inverse square law. That's how it goes. So it just shows that basically it's a distance to speed chart. That's the test result. On this slide, basically, it's a summary of the test result we have. So at distance of 2.68 miles, we got speed of 25 meg. And at distance 5.83 miles, we got a speed of 40 meg. So at this test environment, the maximum distance we got was 5.83 miles. I just want to highlight the point that this distance is very much specific to this test environment because, like Bob was saying, that we chose this location to test the limit of the system. So the system performance is not limited by our environment, but it's more by the system itself. But in other environment, if we deploy the same system, the distance is going to be very much dependent on the environment itself. It can be much, much smaller than what we see here. The other point is that the high speed we were able to get was 64 meg. That is in the real environment. Although when we look at the data sheet, it's going to tell you that it's 100 meg. So the system itself, in theory, is able to get 100 meg, but that is that can be achieved in a controlled environment, like in a lab environment. But in a real world environment, you usually cannot get that speed. The other fact we notice is that when we are more far away from the system, from the access point, when the speed is lower, that's when we also see a delay is longer. The signal takes longer to transmit, and there's also error in the transmission that actually will require retransmission, which also contributes to lower speed.
So what we've learned, we saw some real-world performance parameters when you deploy a state-of-the-art network. Things that we had anticipated before, we're seeing it again. We had impact due to the terrain and the obstacles, and from the results of Eleanor's testing, you could see that. We also identified the operational factors associated with integrating a wireless system. That is, all of the back office, all of the support things that you have to do on the system is somewhat different than you have on a fiber-type system. We took the proof of performance and we applied it in an example wireless build up in the mid-valley, INIAP Valley. We basically identified that area previously as an area that was outside the current public power benefit build expansion. In other words, it's identified as too costly under that program. We applied the wireless example for that area, and in doing so, we deployed this in an area that's very typical for what we'd expect in the county for a wireless system. A lot of mountains, a lot of winding roads, service roads, spurs roads that go off the sides, and very sparse populations. There's a very quick view of the INIAP Valley. The bottom of the graph is about 4 miles from the main highway. We have fiber up to that point. The pins are showing areas that we'd have to actually deploy wireless points in this example build. We didn't actually construct it, it was all designed, theoretical. But that's the area we're talking about. It's roughly 4 miles in there of service territory. A particular interest when you
Bob, don't... Excuse me a second. Yeah. You said in the bottom of the graph, or the picture here, we have fiber up any at how far?
About 6 miles up the river.
About 6 miles. Thank you.
And the bottom of the graph, sorry, you said the bottom of the graph
is 4 miles
from the main highway?
I'm sorry?
You said it's 4 miles from the main highway?
It's about 6 miles up from the main highway, and then the segment that we're looking at is about a 4 mile distance. So that's the overall.
And the fiber goes to that point?
To the bottom part of the...
Of that yellow line?
Yes.
That outlines that. Okay, yes. Gotcha. Thank you.
So looking a little bit closer on this cartoon drawing, the little towers would represent an access point. As it radiates outward, homes that are close to the access point and directly in line of sight would have adequate coverage and probably good performance. As you move behind terrain, as the cartoon mountain there, the signals become partly or completely blocked. And the top right there, for example, there'd be no coverage on that one house on the back side of the mountain. Down at the bottom, what we're trying to represent there is there are single homes up a road that you would have to have a dedicated access point just for one subscriber. In that case, it probably wouldn't make any sense because of the cost. When we look at what it costs to own and operate and maintain, you have the initial investment of the access point and the subscriber units and the backhaul mechanism. You have a network management system to properly manage the active network. And there's also a heightened customer support component of that, wireless being very sensitive to obstructions, whether it be heavy snowfall, foliage, growth, trees that weren't there 5 years ago now are blocking signals, misalignment of the antennas. Customers tend to call in quite a bit with complaints because of those incremental changes in the environment that cause performance issues on the network.
Okay, at this point, what we did is took a step back and looked at how do we analyze this and what is a valid basis to compare the cost between wireless deployment and fiber deployment. Given the parameters within the industry, we chose a 20-year life cycle cost. It's certainly well within the realm of fiber, which is expected to last much longer. Fiber may have a few potential upgrades during that period, but in some areas that don't have dramatic growth in bandwidth demand, you may go the entire 20 years without having to upgrade. Quite the opposite picture with the wireless system, because you're expecting to have to upgrade every 5 to 6 years, and it's generally a forklift upgrade to go to the next generation. Primarily driven by bandwidth demands and customer expectations, in some cases driven by the support requirements from the vendor themselves. When we looked at this area up the Eniat River Road, we deliberately chose a subset of the area to gain a valid comparison between what would it cost to serve it with fiber versus the wireless. When we take that back to a present value, you can see the numbers there, a little over $1 million for wireless to serve the area, and that was with a fiber backhaul because the wireless backhaul was even more expensive than constructing the fiber in that particular backhaul section. $775,000 roughly for the fiber deployment. Both of those were with the same parameters, same take rate, etc. This inferred an overall 40% higher cost in this particular example for an area that was already deemed too expensive to build fiber under the Public Power Benefit Program. We can't just take these numbers and automatically use them as a gauge across the entire county because every different area of the county has to be designed, but it gave us a reliable indicator of what we could expect. And we were able to infer an overall conclusion from that when you truly look at the life cycle cost and what it's going to take to own, operate, and maintain the wireless system, even though it's providing a lesser service than the fiber, it in most cases is going to be more expensive to deploy over that 20-year period. The operations and maintenance costs are estimated for the wireless to be about 5 to 15% higher. And we've seen that play out with a number of implementations on the wireless networks. We need to go back one. So our summary was, first of all, wireless does not provide the same level of service as fiber for a number of the reasons that Bob's already mentioned. We do know that in operating in a radio frequency environment that we're subject to degradation, we're subject to variability in the level of service. We've also now determined that there is a higher cost to build and operate long-term than fiber. And particularly in comparing areas that we've already evaluated under the Public Power Benefit Program as being too expensive. We also know that whether it's wireless or fiber, we still cannot serve all of the customers. There are some customers we just cannot get to. So our conclusion was that wireless, in not providing the same level or quality of service, it also does not provide a cost-effective way to reach that last 8 to 10% of the county. And in general, the long-term cost of wireless in the areas that we've already excluded from the public power benefit is too expensive to place, given that it is a higher cost than fiber. So our recommendation, and this is a continuation of the action item from the 2015 strategic planning, is we would like to come back and revisit and relook at alternative technologies in 5 years, or if we see a major technology shift happen in the industry. And so that's the guidance that we're seeking from the board today.
Commissioners, questions?
The system that you tested, thank you, that was very helpful, very informative. Is this the same system that the SkyFi, is it the same type of equipment, same type of concept?
It is not.
Okay.
It is similar. There are differences, and the reason I say it's not the same system, we looked at it and we would have to be, as the PUD, and particularly looking at a long-term approach to solving this difficult mm-hmm. issue, we would want to be using equipment that occupied licensed spectrum. The equipment that Localtel and most of the other wireless providers are using is in the unlicensed spectrum. So they're constantly dealing with interference issues from their own systems. They're all occupying the same space, and they're expected to agree on not stepping on each other. The difference with the licensed spectrum is that it is governed by the FCC, and you have the right and the expectation that if you've licensed a piece of that spectrum for your application, if somebody interferes with you, you have the ability to defend it and ask for mitigation or correction. That is a significant issue in a long-term operation where you're putting the PUD's name on it.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. I didn't know that. So.
Mike, I have a question. In terms of the proof of concept details on page 18, talking about the performance examples, download speeds of 25 megabits at 2.68 miles, what would the upload speeds look like?
I'm going to look at Eleanor to give us a specific answer.
So in this test case, in this configuration, the upload speed is very similar as the download speed, but the newer versions of firmware actually will allow us to configure it differently, that we can do 75% download, 25% upload. In that configuration, then the download speed will go up and upload speed will go down. Basically, it is the 100% of the resource you can assign uplink, downlink, uplink. So in our setup, it was 50-50. So uplink speed was very similar of the downlink speed in this case.
Thank you.
What's ideal in terms of how you reach that 100%, how you break it down?
In the software, there's a place you can set. So, and this basically how we set it, it's going to be depending on the need. The most customer, we probably would do more download. So in that case, then we'll do set up 75% download, 25% upload.
So it's going to change. It depends on the needs of the customers.
Yeah,
that makes sense.
Yeah, generally speaking, the upload speeds are a fraction of what your download speeds are, because you're normally pulling information off the internet and not so much putting it back
putting it
up.
On. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's typically out of balance, and that's deliberate by design. 25 by 2 or 100 by 10, that's mm-hmm. reflecting the actual use of that service.
Mm-hmm. Where that really goes to, Commissioner, is that as there is in most other systems, there are many, many levers that you can pull to accomplish what your overall objective is. And ultimately, what you're doing is trying to manage the bandwidth in the best manner possible for the most users. And so you're always dealing with compromises, but there are many techniques, and it is a constant issue and requires time to determine is it working the way we expected it to? Is it meeting the customer's needs? Can we change one parameter and maybe make a certain set of customers feel better?
Yeah, that was my next question.
And does it impact negatively a different set of customers? So those are all small dynamic levers that have to be tweaked, and once you've got them tweaked, you're going to be constantly looking at them.
That's challenging.
It is.
Yeah. Okay, thanks.
Sorry. Well, thank you.
So my ultimate question is our recommendation is to wait about 5 years, and unless we see a major shift in technology, not to come back to the board and re-explore any options with the wireless. Does not mean we're not going to continue looking on a regular basis, but I'd like to just establish that as a future check-in point.
Commissioners?
So Mike, so we will be looking at roughly total build out in the county of about 85% or closer to 90%.
Somewhere between 85 and 90.
That's so close.
And
okay.
Honestly, that's going to be a changing number simply because the county's growing,
mm-hmm.
and it depends on where the growth ends up. But yes, yeah, somewhere comfortably in that range.
Okay. Thank you.
Well, my personal opinion is that the product that we could deliver through wireless is inferior to the fiber product. Mm-hmm. And not only is it inferior, but it appears from the map that you showed, individuals that are on the edge of the lake would have good bandwidth, and individuals that would be not on the water's edge would have deteriorating bandwidth, which is not necessarily the type of product that I, as one commissioner, would like to deliver. I think we have a long history of delivering really quality products, and spending a great deal of money right now knowing that it would be an inferior product and still not reach every household. Seems that with new technology coming almost rapidly at us almost every day, having a check back in when technology improves to the point where we can reach more seems to make sense.
Thank you. I will take that as guidance. Thank you. Thank you.
Commissioners, I'd just like to note that Eleanor is relatively new to our organization, been here just less than a year now?
6 months.
6 months. And she brings a skill set you probably saw in the presentation that we really needed and wanted here, and we're really happy that she's here at the PUD. So welcome, Eleanor.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, want to next talk about long-range facilities plan. As the team is coming up, I'll just say quickly that we did open it up for public comment. We received one letter from the Downtown Business Association. I know Linda Hagelin is here today. I'm going to offer up an apology on behalf of Commissioner Smith and myself that last meeting, I think she would have liked to have had an opportunity to speak, and we missed that opportunity, and I feel really bad about that, actually. And so we've invited her to join us today, and that opportunity will be afforded at the end of this presentation. Would just say that the issues that she raised, and then we had some ongoing conversations with both the city and the port, really get to the next step in this process, which is, if we were going to move our facilities, where might we go? And we've done some work on that, but we really, that's not part of this presentation. We've known that that was something that would come if, in fact, the strategic plan would seem like the right one. So the big question today is really just, are we in the right quadrant in terms of thinking about this analysis? And then we would go off and test that analysis with real-world engineering work, location, customer satisfaction tools, all the different work to determine whether, in fact, that the assumptions that we've made in this analysis could be realized in the real world. With that, I'll turn it over to Jeff and to Dan.
Thank you, Steve, and good morning, Commissioners. Jeff Smith, Managing Director of District Services.
Dan Frazier, Director of Shared Services.
And we're back after 2 weeks. We have another 3.5-hour presentation for you, so put your seatbelts on. Just kidding. So on March 20th, we concluded our long-range facilities planning presentation with two questions that we asked you to ponder over the 2 weeks that followed. Number one, do you as a board support proceeding with implementing the recommended plan? It's a principal question right off the bat. And number two, if yes, should a reserve fund be established to pay for the work, and how much initially? So having a couple of weeks to think about that, we're happy to answer any questions. No action that we're asking of you other than a nod of affirmation. If you want us to proceed or if you have an alternative approach, we'd be happy to hear that too. We have more of the presentation, but this principal spot, we thought we'd look to you for your direction.
Good. Commissioners?
Could we hear from Linda first?
Sure.
Is that possible? Steve, how about, are you okay with that?
Absolutely.
Linda Haglin, I'm the Executive Director of the Wenatchee Downtown Association. Excuse me, we are a small 501c3 nonprofit organization, and really what we do is we cheerlead small business in our great historic downtown. You got my undivided attention when you talk about vacating 8 acres, 5 buildings, about 170,000 square feet, and taking some amazing people out of the north end that anchors our downtown. So yeah, I was here, and I spent some quality time that day. Thank you for the apology. It was a long range presentation that day. We had a long day. But I joined you again last Tuesday at your Tri-Commission, and it was really apparent the importance of collaboration. I walked away thinking, now more than ever for our community, how do we collaborate? What is best? And not only where you're vacating, but where you possibly could be going. So with much conversation, and again this morning, thank you, Steve. We are here, and I am here to offer our help in that collaboration. How do we communicate? How do we help that connection to where you'd be going and where you'd be vacating? How do we communicate that? How do we help these small businesses prepare for that impact? It will be big. And yes, this is a great 8 acres. What a great location. But I know from what I do every day, rehabbing these buildings, redoing, is not cheap or easy, and not for the faint of heart. It is really difficult to, one of these buildings, as you mentioned, has been over 90 years in this location, so that's not going to be easy. And how do we communicate that to a downtown that will be nervous about losing that potential business? And then equally, I think it's important, in living here my entire life, what's the impact of where you're going? And how do we help that conversation and communicate that conversation? So I appreciate the opportunity. We're here to help. I'm here to help. My connection is long-term in this community and to the organizations that I volunteer for and help. And I think it's key that we do this together. So I want to be here to connect, and that's why I'm spending this quality time with you. I don't typically do this. So that's just why I'm here. Thank you. It's my job to help to advocate for these businesses that are right now kind of in a challenge, all small businesses. I don't need to tell you, with internet sales and everything they're up against. We have some vacancies in our downtown, but we have, in the last year, six of our buildings change hands. That's new business, new money, new vision in our downtown. That's exciting. But this is all a part of it. So I'm here to be a part of it and to engage in any way I can. So thank you very much for the opportunity.
Thank you, Linda. And you've, as you've been made aware, I think, that there has been a creation of an advisory committee.
I have.
And we, of course, would like to have your input on that committee.
Thank you. I did get an invitation, and I, unfortunately, I will be speaking at the National Main Street Conference that exact same day in May, but that will be the only one I miss. And if me not there, someone that represents a building or a business owner in our downtown, we will, in any way we can, as a board, engage. We're a small nonprofit, but we're a mighty voice in downtown, and we just want this community to grow better together. And I think our Valley, Our Future kind of opened that door for conversation. It isn't just downtown or the PUD or the city or the county or the port. It's all of us working together for a better community on both sides of the river.
Absolutely.
That's what I'm here for.
Absolutely.
So I have a question. Sure. Would you feel more comfortable? I don't know how set in stone the date is of this customer advisory group meeting. I don't know how long it's been on the books. But is that something we could change and accommodate Linda so Linda could be there? Or do you feel really comfortable, Linda, having someone go in your place and represent downtown?
We need
downtown
to listen. We need to listen and learn, and I could certainly send someone if that is okay. We just want to be there listening to help you. And, you know, what was missing is that what's next. And I know that the work the staff did, which is incredible work, but that gave good argument as to the why. But I want the what next part, and what is next for you in both locations, in this location particularly. So I could easily, there is a lot of important people on that board, so I wouldn't want them to change it for me, but I could certainly, if it would be okay, someone with yours for our organization would be great.
Okay. Is that?
Thank you.
Does that work for you, Jeff?
In fact, Lynn and I have talked on the phone, we will fully vet the customer advisory committee process and make it work. We intend for that to be long-term. So we'll make whatever adjustments are required to make it easy for people to attend. Besides that, we also have an internal and external outreach plan that's coming together. It'll be part of an overall implementation plan if you decide to move forward on this, and the board hasn't given us a nod one way or the other at this point. And as I've indicated to her, this is a great opportunity if we decide to vacate this property. It could be a major new addition to the downtown area if done right, and we know there's plenty of interest in that. So we're excited about the possibilities here, and we're not going to abandon the downtown. We're here to help. So before we go on with the next steps, we'd just like to know where you're at in terms of should we move forward with an implementation plan or not.
Are we looking for a motion or just a nod of the
just head? An affirmation at this point.
I think just a nod of the head.
So you have my definite nod of the head with the statements about collaboration and support and working with the downtown association and with the port and, you know, the give and take and the with all of that I can support definitely going ahead.
Okay, thank you.
Same for me. Linda's not here, but as I looked at that presentation the city did a while ago on some conceptual renderings about the downtown area, it just even seemed to put more pressure on us as an organization and our current location. You know, I think we need to continue. I mean, the study is very clear on the challenges our organization faces, and we need to continue to work it for those solutions. But as Ann talked about the collaboration, you know, we're good partners here, and we need to be part of that discussion and be fully involved in that. So I'm in support of continuing with that. And I, for one, as a commissioner, want to put our emphasis on this work by setting aside a reserve fund. And I don't know what point we want to talk about that, but I'm prepared as to make a motion to create that several million dollar reserve fund as a commitment that we need to begin planning or begin committing. There's a difference between the planning part of it and actually making the commitment to move forward. And I believe we as a commission need to put a stamp of approval on that planning effort and put some funds in there to make sure that we're working so that when that plan is ready to go, whatever that looks like and however long that takes, we have some funds to make a commitment to move forward.
That's wonderful. You've just made our business session much easier this afternoon, as we'll be looking for a motion this afternoon. So that's wonderful. And I echo the other commissioner's comments here and would add only one thing to it, and that is out of sometimes adversity, there can be a silver cloud. And I see a potential here that one of the comments I've heard many times is that the Wenatchee area lacks readily available space for businesses, economic development, places for others to move into. And at some point in the presentation here, there, I would anticipate, might be comments as to potential uses for this space should we decide to move on. And in that instance, the future could look quite bright for downtown, having who knows what this would reconfigure as, retail space, housing, all sorts of opportunities and potentials. And to me, that's the exciting future that we haven't discussed yet as to how this might really be very positive for the downtown. So I'm giving you a very positive nod of my head.
Okay. So I think we'll that was pretty clear direction. We appreciate that. And I do want you to know we also heard the second part of this. Just for Linda's benefit, I want to make sure that she knows that the letter that went under Randy's signature was reviewed by all the commissioners and reflects the view of the commission as a whole, and that we felt it would be premature to have that start the conversation about what's the future for this site in advance of the board looking at the plan and deciding whether we were even open to the idea of moving. But now that we're to that point, it is clearly timely to have that conversation and think about, so what are the options for this site, and what are our alternatives for being able to move to someplace else. So we will embrace that mission and work to try to make sure that we have a good community discussion about where we might go and what might happen to here.
Good. And as far as the reserve fund, that'll be addressed in a motion proposed for this afternoon. So our next step is to develop an implementation plan within the next 60 to 90 days, which we'll bring back to you. But at a high level, Dan will explain what that plan is currently envisioned.
Thank you, commissioners. I appreciate the direction. I like the idea of a stamp of approval. As we work through this process, we talked a lot about how, what would we do, how would we be configured. But now we've got to figure out how we would actually do it. So this is what implementation planning is all about. It's that final piece of the strategic plan where we say we know what we're likely to do. Now, how would we achieve those goals? And there's a number of sections, and there's lots of different ways to look at implementation planning, but the approach we're taking is how we do a lot of our other capital facilities plans or comprehensive plans is you look at major elements, and these have some peculiarities about a big project like this. And the first one we put on there is the method of procurement. This is a project that, or a suite of projects, that could lend itself to something the district normally does not do, which is an alternative form of project delivery. You heard, I believe, Randy Cook, our consultant, talk about how Washington School was delivered. So this is something we're just starting into the process of the pros and cons of these different ways of doing business, unlike the district has done before. There, it does spread some risk around. There's some risk sharing that occurs here. It can come with a premium price, so we want to balance all those type of considerations. So that's one of the first things we'll look at. Next is schedule. We presented a schedule that had a very aggressive implementation plan, and that was to look at what the, it's almost a worst case when you do a net present value. If the quicker you do the work, you're kind of fighting against the discount rate. So if we stretched it just a little bit, it really wouldn't affect too much. There is an inflationary pressure that's always coming on with construction. So it would be working kind of against inflation, but with our discount rate. So we could change this scheduling a little bit over time. One of the key components of the schedule is that the work to do the like a major relocation of the headquarters facilities, it is a pretty finite time to do that project. So any rescheduling of that would really delay the implementation. It wouldn't really stretch out very well because your economics get worse as you implement a program over a longer period of time. So we'll be doing lots of iterations of scheduling. And that schedule has to include all the different elements of the plan. So number one, resources. What kind of resources does the district need to apply to this project? It's a major, major undertaking. So those are both internal resources, project managers, construction managers. There are also external resources, consultant teams, and some of this may be contracted labor. We really need to flesh that out and see what resources we put to it. The good side is all those costs that we've developed over the last couple of years are in the plan. So whenever we get down to figuring out what's the best way to do it, we have it funded in those cost estimates. The next thing, obviously, finance. How does this fit in with the district's overall financial forecasting or financial plan? We've worked with strategic finance to develop the first look of that. At some point, we'll be running different scenarios through that forecast to see what moving projects does. And then we'll have a plan going forward with how we would finance it. Another component we look at everything is risk. One of the big issues with this is schedule risk. How does this evolving schedule provide us different security against risk, hedge against risk, or does it expose us to other risk? Another area is how, this is something that appears in our risk register quite frequently, is the resource risk. We have other big projects coming up. We have a lot of them already on the books. We have other ones in the forecast, and how does this project affect those projects' risk? Obviously, what we've been talking about up to this point earlier today is the communication, the work, the external and the internal communication. So we want to work with external affairs to really have a robust external stakeholder engagement. This is, of course, those will be affecting where we go and where we leave. It also is the community at large, the larger, the whole Chelan County, who we serve. See what their input is. What do we want the customer facing portions of this facility to look like? What kind of facilities would be nice for the community? Our auditorium is used extensively by the public, so we assume we're going to have that type of use. Now, would the boardroom be better served in that kind of public space or tucked up hidden away on the third floor? I think we know where we'd like to be, where the public can get to the meetings easier. So those kind of things will happen over the period of time. And of course, the local agencies, the city, the county, the port, and the district need to get together to talk about things like land use, redevelopment, all those things that we need to coordinate. Approvals are a big part of any of these projects, and obviously the board approval is the first step in this process. Then we have internal processes for approving each project through our portfolio review committee, and then again, wherever we end up, there's environmental permitting, building permits, all those kind of things. We need to identify what those are. And those can really drive schedule quite a bit. So this is a very iterative process as we go through the scheduling, how those permits may impact our scheduling and ultimately our financing. And finally, pre-design. So pre-design, this is something you can slice about 100 different ways, but the way we're looking to do this is the work that was done to get to the plan that we showed you 2 weeks ago, that is called high-level programming. So we know we need 10,000 square feet of a use, but we don't know where that use needs to be. Does it need to be close to a different use? Does it need to be some shops, some offices? So then we get down into what's called detailed programming. This is where we go in and put blocks of space that have adjacencies, that have characteristics about how they're going to be used. So this one needs to be close to the border of the property. This one needs to be interior. It's allowed operation. This one has to be close to the crews. So that's where we get into the more detailed programming. And from that, we'll develop the site conceptual plan, and then the actual we call pre-schematic. And the pre-schematic plan will take much longer than this implementation plan. We're looking at 60 to 90 days to get the bulk of the implementation plan done, but the pre-schematic could take really the rest of the year to complete. But in 60 to 90 days, we really plan on having all these key components put together with a recommendation for how we would implement, and the pre-design will still be underway at that point. Any questions so far? So with this direction, there are two high-priority projects which we would need to really focus on over the next immediate future. The first being that property selection and acquisition that Steve spoke to. Now we have to figure out where this fits. And so finding out what site is ideal for the operation we've planned, and there are multiple different ideas on how to do that. We'll be working on that site selection and then identifying parcels that meet the criteria. And then, and finally, working with those landowners and public agencies to figure out how we acquire that property. And this is really where that collaboration with the other agencies is going to be key in identifying those parcels. So that's our first next step. Our next step.
There's another long-term project that actually requires immediate attention, and Kirk is going to tell you about need for storage at Rock Island.
Kirk Hudson, Managing Director of Generation and Transmission. We do have an immediate need for storage at Rock Island. On the tour, you saw many of the buildings up there that are completely full. When we have the need to get at something, we have to empty great portions of those buildings just to get at some of that equipment. The other thing you did not see that day, we didn't have time, was all the equipment that we're storing inside the powerhouses, Rock Island 1 and Rock Island 2. So we have a great need for storage facility on the Powerhouse 2 side. We've been in the process of design. We actually started design earlier this year. It was a major pressing need, so we've kept moving along those lines. What we didn't have was all the details and whether the facility plan would be approved, and so that's the part of the implementation plan that we're working through. But so I would say just some major changes with having a facility plan that we will incorporate into that design are a couple of things. One would be the amount of storage space. With our traditional approach, we would do bare minimum. We would look at a facility that would be much more short-lived than we would a long-term facility plan. And then some of the other things we would be adding and incorporating into this design of the site work. So now that there's a master facility plan, we want to incorporate the storage facility into the other buildings that might come up later on. So that's going to involve additional site work to be prepared, that we wouldn't be putting something that would be in the way of something in the future. So all those considerations are going into the design as we speak. We've got another 3 months or so to complete the design. And what we would do is that we'd anticipate coming back perhaps even as early as later this summer with a budget revision for that project where design would be complete. We'd be ready to go out to bid actually later this year. So that's the timing we're looking at bringing back and, to the board is later this summer for a budget revision for that storage facility.
So we will begin immediately working on development of that implementation plan back within 90 days. Do want to use this opportunity to recognize Sam Dilley sitting over here. Sam did the front half of this and spent many, many weeks and months developing the front end of it, and now is working full-time on the customer information system project along with meter data management and automated meter reading. He just provided a very strong basis and the perfect handoff point, frankly, for Dan to take it on and finish it off, to the point that we end up with our staffing and resource plan, which will include a project manager. So we're available for any questions you might have. Again, the motion for the fund creation would happen this afternoon as part of the regular agenda.
So just to be clear, so Jeff... So with our, you know, nod of our head, then you will take these next steps, which includes completing the design and going ahead with the construction of the Rock Island storage building.
That's correct.
So without a budgeted number for just that, did I miss something?
No, we're going to do the... Okay, thank you.
So just to clarify there, we would come back to the board with a budget revision for that storage facility. We're proceeding with the design, and we're incorporating the design and the major elements of a longer-term facility plan into that design. That's what the nod of the head is allowing us to do, is continue to come and develop that project and then come back with a total cost
for
the board to approve.
Yeah, thank you. I totally support it. I just wanted to be clear on that.
Maybe I could take a second and try to add some more general clarity around this, too. So strategically, what's happening here is we are just choosing. We went off and analyzed a whole bunch of options, 14 total options, and we're saying, okay, this is where we're going to focus our efforts now. And what the district has lacked is a direction with respect to facilities. Where are we trying to get to? Now, that doesn't mean that we've made specific decisions about building or remodeling particular buildings. It doesn't mean that we have made a decision to move. It means that we're going to go explore the specific options that were presented to you at the last meeting, as these are our preferred alternatives at this moment, trying to figure out whether, in fact, we can actually deliver something in the real world consistent with the assumptions that were used in the planning process. So the one exception to that is just the Rock Island Storage, because what was happening there is we were doing the same thing we've done in the past. We were doing something that was really only going to be an interim solution. It's going to work for 5 years. And so now we're trying to get out of that mode and think long term. And we're saying, boy, if we were really trying to create best value for the long term here, we would be doing a bigger fix with respect to Rock Island Storage. That's the design work that's now being done that ultimately would be brought back to you. That would apply to everything else that we do here. So whether it's as little as a building at Rocky Reach or as big as the decision to move to north of the bridge, all of that, we'll be doing more work on and bringing it back, and you'll have the opportunity to test, well, is this working out the way that we thought when we put the plan together, and does it continue to make sense for us or not? And then decisions on individual projects as we move forward.
Was the storage facility part of the original plan out there anyway, or is this an addition, or what you're saying, this is the first step of those several building changes out there?
We were planning to build a storage facility out there to begin with. It was going to be a much smaller storage facility, and as Steve articulated very well, it would be short-lived, much shorter in life, and it would be just what we've done in the past, and not in light and consistent with a master facility plan. So we actually had $1.1 million budgeted this year for part of that effort, as well as O&M dollars for design. So that's what we'd be coming back to revise, which would be consistent with a longer term approach.
So the only thing, and maybe this isn't the time to do this, but I think right up front, the thing that I would like to emphasize is purpose-built construction. That as we go into this planning, that, and I've dealt with this in my prior life, that as you build something and then over the years things start changing, and then all of a sudden you get to the point where nothing makes sense anymore. I guess I want some assurances that if it's built, that's the purpose, and we're not going to be piecemealing things together as we need them later on. That, so that's just my point.
Well, to address that, this actually came up really early in the high-level programming, that we needed a storage facility, and it did grow over time. With the building itself that Kirk mentioned was in the budget, we knew that was on the table as a near-term need, and then we started identifying all the other needs on the site, and that's how it became this larger, more robust building, and it's a building that has that long-term view of, it's tilt-up concrete construction. It's not something that's a short term. It's purpose built for what we need.
You may recall from the presentations a couple of weeks ago that at a very high level we talked about Rock Island with a storage building, the tool room, the other structures that need to be relocated so we're not driving back and forth across the dam all the time. Mm-hmm. The headquarters site along with Holly Street, that was proposed for the operations center, and Rocky Reach was proposed for the repurposing of the central maintenance building plus some additional structures. At a high level,
I think what might give at least this commissioner some comfort is knowing that it's all part of the master plan, and maybe that's the question I hear coming up now amongst the other commissioners, is that if you can demonstrate to us at some point in the future that here's the master plan, this was a piece of it anyway, it might bring additional comfort.
So, commissioners, in terms of process, we use terms like nod of the head and those kinds of things, but. The perspective I have on these things is that we're bringing these to you as information as to what staff's next steps are, primarily for information and transparency, so that you will understand. And I think of it more in terms of the lawyer and me as without objection, here's what we're going to continue to do to ensure that you think we're moving along the same path and you have that opportunity to course correct as we go. But as Steve mentioned, all of those decision points must come later before the board. And that's the time, I think, if not sooner along the way as part of the journey, that you'll see how those things begin to fit together as part of the master plan.
Just a simple question. One of the things that impressed me at Rocky Reach was the large covered area for vehicles to park under. And why it impressed me is because the price of a single tire, I thought I was complaining when I had to buy tires for my car. I've got nothing to complain about compared to the price of those tires. And, of course, the sun decays the tires and their life is shortened significantly. Are in this large storage area, are we creating accommodation for vehicles?
There is not in this storage. This building is primarily initially rehab storage facility and then inventory controlled. If you recall the building we went to before we went into the crew room at Rocky Reach or Rock Island was kind of an old metal sided building. Some of that those materials would be in the other half of this facility. We are still looking at the amount of vehicles we can get undercover and looking at ways even in the short term like we did at Rocky Reach to get things undercover.
Okay. Thank you. Well, I guess you've gotten your nod of your head from the commissioners. Thank you.
Thank you, commissioners.
Before you go, any comments from the public? Question? No. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, next up, commissioners, we have committed to doing outreach around the automated metering infrastructure program that we're now exploring. You've already seen the business case on it. We'll be doing a lot of public meetings over the course of the next month. I want to ask Andy Wendell and Suzanne Hartman to provide you a review of the materials that we'll be using as well as the specifics around the outreach program.
Good morning, Commissioners. Andy Wendell, Director of Customer Service. With me is Suzanne Hartman, Communications Manager. As Steve had mentioned, we are just getting ready to launch a big effort with community outreach specific to the advanced two-way metering systems. We're excited for this opportunity. I just want to talk to you just briefly about some of the overarching objectives that we have, and then Suzanne can walk us through some of the material, some of the handouts. Did you all get a handout? No. So just looking at some of our top objectives, really industry experts have suggested that the primary driver in community outreach for advanced two-way metering is really education. Educating staff and educating the community on these technologies, how the utility intends to use them, what benefits that these technologies bring to our customers. Right here I have an advanced two-way meter. And this is a sample that was recently sent to me. This is a water meter. It's an advanced water meter as well. Under our business case, our 6,500 water meters can talk to our electric meters. So through an education process, we intend to bring that information forward to our customers and talk about just what is happening here. How frequently are these devices talking to each other? What information are they passing? What are the RF or radio frequency challenges with that information? What is the privacy of that information going back and forth? And is it secure? Can somebody hack into this? So a large part of our outreach coming up in the next couple of weeks is around those three topics, health, security, safety, and how the utility intends on using this information to bring value to our customers for the long term. Additionally, we want to make sure that we listen to our stakeholders. We take their input and we bring it back and work it into our models. We're going to be providing customers access to some of the industry professionals. A month ago, you heard from UtilityWorks, who is an industry professional that we are working with, who has deployed hundreds of thousands of advanced two-way meters across the country and has done quite a bit of outreach and community engagement with the technology from an education standpoint. So we're certainly going to be leveraging them in three of our large community meetings in Chelan, Leavenworth, and Wenatchee. We want to educate customers, obviously, before deployment, not just what the technology is doing, but what can they expect during the deployment? Is there going to be an interruption in their service, particularly a commercial or industrial customer? They've got a lot of questions about that, so we'll be talking to them about that. Suzanne and her team have developed fantastic frequently asked questions, and so we're going to make sure our customers and stakeholders understand where they'll have access to this information on our website, direct mailers, and other areas. And then finally, you know, the goal here, or the objective here, is to be very open and very transparent about what we are doing and why we are doing it. There's nothing to hide here. It's a wonderful story. This is fantastic technology. It will bring value for the most and for the longest. So that's what we're kicking off, and Suzanne, I'll let you dive in there a little bit.
Good morning, Commissioner. Suzanne Hartman, Communications Manager. And we've already launched into the outreach. You may have seen in your mailbox a direct mail postcard that went to all of our customers, both commercial and residential customers. We also issued a press release last week. We have some advertising that's appearing in not only the Wenatchee World, but all the weeklies and online, Gold Lake Chelan, and then excuse me. We've also publicized all of the meetings that we have scheduled, and they've been on social media as well. In your packet, you'll also see the frequently asked questions that Andy referenced. Those are online. We have a great website that provides an abundance of information, not just our information, but information we've been gathering from all around the country about the topics that Andy identified. And that website is chelanpud.org, advanced meters. So that's an easy one, fairly easy one to remember. The board's behind me, and then in your packet also will be the ones that we'll use at the community meetings, and we'll use them as merely talking points, but we hope that it'll bring forward some questions that our customers might have of us about the meters and what they mean to them. And then you also have a schedule in front of you of the various meetings, not only the larger meetings that Andy mentioned, but also the meetings that we'll be doing with a number of our stakeholders, from civic groups to our local cities. We'll be doing presentations throughout the county, and we welcome anybody who would like for us to do more presentations or come to their organization or just get in touch with us. On Friday, an email, some of you may be on that email distribution list, an email went out to about 30,000 of our customers for whom we have emails, and it was a newsletter similar to the press release that was issued, but it was a newsletter, and from that newsletter, I received feedback from seven customers so far, and it's interesting feedback. Two of the seven customers asked if they could volunteer to be to install the digital meters as a test, if we wanted that. Only we got one negative response from a customer about the meters, and the other response is, let's go to it, let's get it done. And so that's encouraging. Obviously, that's not a huge response, seven responses, but I found that fairly interesting in a short period of time to get that kind of response. With that, Andy?
So the primary meeting's being held Wenatchee at the PIBUS facility on April 11th. That's coming up next week at 6:30. Also in Leavenworth at the Fire Hall, there will be a public meeting on the 12th at 6:30. And the Chelan Chamber of Commerce on April 13th at 6:30. Those are our designated community meetings where the Utility Works Consulting group will be here with our customers. Yeah, yes, Commissioner.
Unfortunately, we have our annual Washington PUD Association meeting in Olympia, April 12, 13, 14. And it is the annual meeting where we elect new officers, so we all need to be there. So that's unfortunate. So the Leavenworth, 6:30 p.m., yeah. I'm not sure any of us can attend either of those.
Okay. We do have other opportunities. As you can see, there are other meetings in Plain, April 8th, the Beaver Valley Lodge.
And Lake Wenatchee, April 8th. And then also in Wenatchee, we're also having a meeting on April 8th. It's a combination meeting with an already scheduled meeting, but it'll be at Town Toyota Center. So we'll be, yeah.
Sorry, didn't mean to interrupt. No, will there be another meeting in Chelan? I think I saw something at the Earth Fair, because Chelan does have a fairly large organized group of folks who are opposed this whole metering process.
And we have heard from someone from Manson already, and I don't think they were able to make it here today, but they indicated that they would be at the Chelan, at a meeting coming up, and I assumed that was a Chelan meeting.
What's going on at you're just going to have a booth and have handouts at the Earth Fair in Chelan?
Similar to last year, we'll have a booth, and we'll have probably not all four boards, because, as you know, the wind can be a little telling up there. But we will have one board that will summarize these four points, and we'll have all of the materials we currently have, and we'll have someone there to be able to talk to people.
I'm looking again. When is that, Suzanne? It's on here.
April 15th is the Earth Day, which is 9 to 4 p.m.
Okay, good.
At Riverwalk.
So there's another opportunity for us to be available.
Commissioner, in Chelan. Again, if you feel like there's another meeting that you would like to see scheduled this month, please let us know.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Thank you.
We may not be able to have Utility Works present at that meeting. We could potentially arrange a call-in.
Yeah.
But absolutely, if there's a special interest group that would like to meet,
absolutely,
I'm more than happy to schedule them. In addition to these, we're also looking for opportunities to talk with other interest groups. As an example, the North Central Realtors Association, we're scheduling some time with them, as well as the North Central Builders Association. And we're looking for an opportunity to talk with IBEW and then the local electricians group as well, talking about the use of this technology in their businesses. So this is a dynamic list that's growing a little bit as we move along. So with that, that's the direction that we're going. Are there any other thoughts, questions, or concerns?
Good outreach, which I'm happy to see that, because it's going to be really important.
And please let us know if you hear of anybody who would like additional presentations.
Great. Thank you. I'll extend an invitation to the public. Any comments, questions? No? Thank you.
Thank you.
Good presentation.
Suzanne, can I just check? Did you want to do anything else about Earth Day presentations at this time?
Thank you. We will be at both Earth Days, which Chelan is on April 15th, and then in Leavenworth on April 23rd. That one's from noon to 4 p.m. So we'll be out in force on both of those. I'm hoping for good weather, of course, and no wind.
Good luck.
I might just take a second to do a couple of manager items, because we're finished with our morning agenda, and just help us to move through the afternoon, if that's okay.
Yes.
First, a quick report on the fire from yesterday. Certainly very very hot, very smoky fire that created a lot of challenges. We have had some damage to electrical systems, some damage to fiber. We have folks out today working on that, trying to do repairs. We're fortunate in one respect that the biggest worry is that it would spread, and we didn't end up with that problem. The fire was hot for a long time last night, so it was difficult to get in and do some of that repair work. So they're after it today, and hopefully we'll get everything back up in the next day or two. Second thing, just wanted to make sure that you're aware that, recall that we have spent a lot of time on the issue that we call early action credit, where we would work with the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission to get credit in the licensing process for actions that are taken in advance of a license being issued. Their current policy does not allow that. We think that that's unfortunate, and that it doesn't encourage good public policy in terms of working with stakeholders and agreeing on issues in advance, and even beginning to implement them in advance, recognizing that there should be credit given for that. And if there isn't, there's a discouragement for trying to get in front of issues and solve them. The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission did issue a notice of inquiry on that last fall. The deadline for comments passed about a week ago. We're going to actually come back and give you a full summary of all the comments that were heard at the next board meeting. We did submit comments. Commission actually created a new option in their proposal, and that was to just do 50-year licenses. Currently, the fact that you don't get credit affects the term of your license, whether it be 30 to 50 years. They proposed a consideration of just doing 50-year licenses.
Steve, that'd be FERC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission?
Yes.
When you said commission, all right.
Yes. And so we would be supportive of that. We also would be supportive of early action credit, and we've submitted comments along both those lines. There were also joint comments filed by a wide range of utilities that included American Public Power Association, Large Public Power Council that we are a party to as well, and then a variety of comments from other folks. So we'll be coming back and just giving you details about that at the next board meeting. But we felt really good about the fact that the commission has even entertained this discussion. And I'll just say from the comments we've seen so far, we think that this is continues to be a real opportunity. We don't see the kind of strong opposition that might cause nothing to happen. It looks like there's going to be a real opportunity to be able to make something happen here. And I think that's it for manager comments.
Okay. Do we have any commission items?
So, commissioners, we do have one, actually. So I was holding on to this. Sheila has been so kind. I don't know if you have in front of you to prepare the memo with the proposed motions to reschedule the commissioner meetings that we talked about at the workshop last Thursday. This is the June 19th, July 3rd, and July 17th meetings to be reordered.
Let me just describe that the fundamental challenge here is that the APPA National Convention is scheduled at the same time as one of our board meetings in June, and then July 4th falls on a Tuesday this year, which we are currently scheduled to meet on the 3rd. So we would have people coming in for the 3rd, and just awkward relative to the way that the holiday falls this year. So we have worked through a proposal where we would end up with the same number of meetings. July is a 5-Monday month, which means that we would normally be missing and have a 3-week interlude between meetings. So we've restructured this in a fashion where we avoid the APPA convention and we avoid July 3rd and end up with the same number of meetings.
So, Eric,
yes.
So could we do this?
All in one motion would be great.
One motion. All right.
Yes,
Mr.
thank you,
Chairman. I move that we reschedule the regularly scheduled board meeting dates and move the regular meetings that are scheduled on June. I'll state those moves with the dates. Number one, June 19th, move to June 26th, 2017. July 3rd to July 10, 2017. And July 17 to July 24th, 2017. And all meetings are scheduled to begin at 10 a.m.
Thank you, Commissioner.
So are you asking for a motion at this time?
I think it was just made.
Okay.
Okay.
Second.
All right. Any discussion? No.
Good changes.
Okay. Good changes.
All those in favor.
All those in favor. Say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, say no. Motion carries.
Thank you, Commissioners.
Thank you.
Okay. And I don't have anything else. No, I have no more commission items.
No. Nothing. Well, I think what we'll do is we'll break early, we'll recess for lunch, and begin our business session at 1 o'clock.
Good.
Thank you.
Very good.
So I left just a short question to address that underpayment or the lack of
We are still recording here. One second.
Okay, thank you.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
To go in the
Good afternoon and welcome to the April 3rd, 2017 business session of the Chelan County Public Utility District Commission meeting. I'd like to remind everyone to please silence your cell phones and any other electronic devices you may have. I'd also like to welcome all of our visitors today. We place great value on the public's input at our meetings. And since these meetings are recorded, if you wish to address any item on the agenda,
We ask that you please come to the microphone, speak clearly, state your name, address for the record. And additionally, in order to keep our agenda on track today, please limit your comments to 3 minutes and allow others in the audience to speak before you comment for a second time. So on the consent agenda, Eric, I understand that you have an addition for the consent agenda.
I do, commissioners. Thank you. So under item 8, at the consent agenda, the commissioner knows that we approve the vouchers, and then there are some follow-on bullet points improving certain expenditures at every board meeting, actually. So this in this instance, at the time that the agenda was put in place, we had one approval for payment that did not make the list, and as a result, it does not appear on your agenda. We do need to see that particular payment is made. To make it in a timely fashion, it needs to be placed on this agenda. So what I've done for the commissioners is I've given you a brief motion. I apologize, it's not as fancy as the memorandum format that Sheila does, since I did it myself. But in any event, I would ask the commissioners, if they're so inclined, to move to include the approval as identified in the motion, which is a payment to Compunent in the amount of $552,216.66 for phone system replacement equipment, including technical support, to the consent agenda, because it was a late addition, and because of the amount, I think that the motion to add it to the consent agenda is appropriate before there is action on the consent agenda. An alternative might be to move to approve the consent agenda as proposed, and then have a separate motion seeking to approve this particular expenditure. They are six of the other. So whichever the board is inclined, it would be appropriate and acceptable.
Mr. Yes. Chairman, and we don't need fancy. Actually, that was pretty fancy and formal. So I move, Mr. Chairman, to add approval for payment to Compunet Inc. in the amount of $552,216.66 for phone replacement equipment, including technical support, to the payment approvals listed in the consent agenda.
Is there a second?
A second.
It's been moved and seconded. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed signify by saying no. The motion is carried.
Thank you, Commissioner.
So then we move on to the consent agenda, which is in front of us. Commissioners, what are your wishes?
Move approval for the consent agenda as detailed.
Which I guess, commissioners, I would suggest to you was adjusted this morning to also include resolution number 10.
I'll second the motion.
The motion has been moved and seconded. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed, say no. The motion is carried.
Thank you, Commissioner.
We're now down to the regular agenda. Steve, I'll turn this over to you.
This is number 11, a resolution authorizing the general manager to enter into a task authorization services agreement, SA number 17-006, with the United States Department of Agriculture, Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service, Wildlife Service of Olympia, Washington, for pike minnow, avian predator, and nuisance animal control.
Thank you.
Over to Lance. Good
afternoon, commissioners. My name is Lance Keller. I'm a senior fisheries biologist with the district, and with me today also is Vaughn Pope, senior wildlife biologist with the district. We're bringing this resolution forward to authorize the general manager to enter a service-based contract with the United States Department of Agriculture and Wildlife Services. This is a task-based service agreement. Task one is the northern pike minnow control portion of it, which I manage, and then Vaughn manages task two, which is the nuisance bird and animal control that we have at district facilities. So I will explain task one. Vaughn will explain task two. The total not to exceed amount for this service agreement this year is $467,868, which is an overall increase of 5.7%. like I previously mentioned, task one is the pike minnow control effort. We have been doing this, had the USDA on contract for this since 2003. They do provide a turnkey service in the fact that they do have four boats, each that are staffed with three fishermen that move between Rocky Reach and Rock Island Reservoir as they see fit, from May 1st through the end of September, targeting northern pike minnow, which concentrate in our project waters and predate upon out-migrating juvenile salmon steelhead smolts. This is a tool that we have used to meet our HCP survival obligations. Rocky Reach was met in 2011, excuse me, Rock Island in 2010. And since it was a tool that we used to meet those survival standards, we do have to keep that in place for the life of the HCP. So that is the reason why we continue forward. We do examine this contract on an annual basis to make sure that we are getting the best cost for service. And looking back at the 2016 results, the USDA removed 60,327 pike minnow from Rocky Reach and Rock Island reservoirs. When we compare that to the overall 2016 Northern Pike Minnow Control Program for the district, which removed 91,522, the USDA is roughly 66% of our overall program effort. So they do remove quite a few fish. We do have an estimate as to the number of smolt consumed by a pike minnow in our project waters. Our office does consider that to be very conservative. It's based on a study done in the mid-90s below Rocky Reach, and they estimated that a pike minnow in the tail race of Rocky Reach will consume 2 smolts a week. When we remove these fish, we do examine them, and we see them coming up with 3, 5, 7 smolts sometimes. So we do understand that estimate is very conservative. But if we take that consumption rate and multiply it over a 15-week out-migration, we can assume very conservatively, if those fish were to remain in the project waters and allow to predate at that 2 smolt per week rate over a 15-week out-migration, that they would have consumed 1.9 million smolts in our project waters. So we do have a very significant impact here on that population, providing safe passage for juvenile salmon and steelhead. The cost per fish for the USDA program last year was $6.68. We typically look to the bounty program that is funded by the BPA in the lower river as a cost comparison to see how we measure up to that program. And last year, the BPA program came in at $7.85 per fish. So based on that, we're still getting a good cost for the service that we're being provided in our project waters. I mentioned previously that there was an overall cost increase to the overall contract. When you look at task one, that portion of the contract has increased 5.5% this year. And we discussed this quite a bit at pre-agenda. And this is mainly due to some salary increases. Not all of it is salary increases. There is a small vehicle cost increase. But we've had some significant changes inside the program itself. We've actually have an employee that's moving into a lead project role. His official title is lead project role, so it's essentially a promotion for him. He has been supervising the 17 employees that has been involved in this program for years, and he's now being recognized for that. So we do see a substantial increase in his wage there. Mm-hmm. With that change in his job duties, we also have added what we call an on-call floater. And essentially his capacity is that on a need basis, he could come out, fill in for that project lead if he has to deal with other issues that arise in the day-to-day operations. And that allows to keep the flexibility of the program, maintain the efficiency, and then also keep our catch rates fairly high for this program so we can continue to keep this cost per fish in an acceptable range. The addition of the floater was a 2.5% increase to the salaries, and then there was also a 1.63% cost of living increase. So once we factor all those out, the overall salary increase for the USDA on the task one side of things does come out to roughly 3.4%, I believe. So it is kind of right in line with what we expect to see there. So
what's the average size of caught fish?
That's a very good question. So that's another tool that we actually utilize to evaluate the success of the program, Fisher McKenna. Back when we started in 2003, the overall size of the fish that we caught through the USDA program was 236 millimeters. A lot of these fish were some large fish that were very, very, you know, they're the big reproducers of the population. We saw that average size per fish actually creep up to 2009 to 245 millimeters. And the district was really in the home stretch on some of our HCP survival studies. So we actually increased this effort slightly. And now we actually have that observed average length per fish down to 183 millimeters. And we continue to see a downward trend. So that's another tool that we use to evaluate the success of the program.
So I had to look. The 244 is 9.64 inches.
Yeah, excuse me, sorry.
Thank you, Eric.
Yeah.
I was trying to do it in my head, convert millimeters to meters.
I tried to and then realized that's a better tool.
Perfect.
My apologies.
Perfect.
So my question that I would have is how do these fish reproduce? One pike minnow can reproduce how many baby pike minnows?
That's a very good question. I'd have to really look at the literature. For that, we do have a general spawning movement in our project waters up to the Chelan Falls area, and so we're kind of also able to evaluate ladder counts based on that movement out of the grant project through our project into Chelan Falls, and we have continued to see a suppressed level of ladder passage over the years, and then also we're continuing to maintain that low. But as far as how fecund those fish are is what we would call that in the fisheries world. I'd have to look to the literature, and I can try to get some numbers. But then there's also a lot of factors that come into play. These fish are piscivorous by nature, and they will, which means they're fish eating other fish. But they will also eat them their other northern pike minnow brothers and sisters as they're rearing up. So I don't believe there's really been a lot of studies done on spawning of northern pike minnow and what that translates to an age class structure 3-4 years out. But I can try and take a look and see if I can get an idea for you.
Well, the source of the question really is that if we're pulling 60,000 out, how many new babies are being born every year? Are we holding steady? Are we kind of decreasing the population, or are we having a minimal impact?
I think we are actually having a very good impact through the decrease in the ladder counts, and then also seeing that average length continue to hold low and continue to decrease as well tells me that we've actually essentially taken that that age structure of that population that was present during the signing of the HCP, and we've really shrunken it down to where there's the average size of the fish is on the smaller side, and thus really can't impact the population of outmigrating juvenile salmon steelhead to the certain extent that that population could back in 2003. Good. So
thank you.
Yeah,
very interesting. Yes.
Yeah, I liked all the numbers, okay. Lance. That was great.
Thank you.
The only one I didn't get down, I missed it. When was the 10-year check-in for Rocky Reach, and when was the 10-year check-in for Rock Island?
Yeah, so based on the fact that we have achieved survival standards at Rocky Reach in 2011, our HCP check-in is slated right now to be 2021.
Okay.
And for Rock Island, we achieved those survival standards for spring species in 2010, and we're slated for a 2020 check-in study at Rock Island.
And so what we need to do is just maintain those survival standards,
yep.
Whatever it takes.
Yep, exactly. And then it goes back to the tools that we have in place when we meet those survival standards. We can't just the following year remove those tools.
Right.
And you know, at the same time, these are cost-effective tools when you start looking at improvements to the projects for additional fish passage structures, additional spill levels that we see in the lower river. When we start thinking in that realm of possibility for tools that are left in the toolbox, if this tool didn't work, this tool is cost effective when we start looking at those other options.
Yeah, that's good. I mean, I know how critical it is that we meet those survival standards.
And I think some of these results of the pike minnow that we see the average length continue to decrease, and then also the pike minnow moving up into our project waters from Grant, I think we can take some, take some faith in that and say, we put ourselves in a good position to meet those survival standards come check-in time.
Good. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We're commissioners. We're looking maybe.
For we got tests.
Yeah,
sorry.
Vaughn's going to do that.
Sorry. Good afternoon, commissioners. Vaughn Pope, senior wildlife biologist with the district. I manage task two of this contract, which is relatively small compared to task one. But we combine this contract that we manage for the USDA. It's a lot of the same staff for them, similar staff for us, and we get some efficiencies having one contract rather than many. So, task two for this contract is $43,027. It has two components to it. This task, one is nuisance bird and animal control. So in this case, the USDA, at our request, we have some scheduled work that goes on routinely, and then there's a lot of on-call work too, where they control nuisance bird and animals, including pigeons, marmots, gophers, beaver, animals that at times create some human health and safety issues for our staff, our employees. So they're managed for that regard, as well as causing damage to district infrastructure, holes, burrowing, digging, feces accumulation, these kind of things. So USDA does a lot of work for us at our facilities. Last year, they removed over 300 pigeons and 13 marmots. And in the last few weeks, we've been getting some mergansers that have gotten into some of our ponds where we have a bunch of our recently raised fish. So they do that work
for us. Not mergansers.
Yeah.
I love mergansers. They're so pretty.
They are. Again, they're there. That's part of the task is this nuisance bird and animal control. And then we also have the piscivorous bird management, which is supports the HCP component for our habitat conservation plans. We've done bird studies during the habitat conservation, during getting the survival estimates, and are currently where we are. So again, we need to have those same tools available. So we do hire the USDA to, they have the permits, federal permits, take permits, and the ability to take, if necessary, animals that are directly affecting smolt migration in our project. So last year we removed 56 cormorants under the last contract, 56 cormorants and 17 mergansers during the process of that contract to help reduce impacts of smolt or predation by these birds, and in some cases even mammals. So as Lance mentioned, this, you know, the overall contract had an increase. This project was an overall 7.7% increase because of the particular individual that got the promotion is the primary person for my task. So there was a large salary component to that increase, and then a small vehicle increase too. So any questions about task two of the contract?
I was just curious about the cormorants. I never see them.
The cormorants?
Yeah. Where do you usually see them?
Rock Island, the Rock Island Four Bay.
Not at Rocky Reach. So.
Yeah. They forage up there, but they roost in the Rock Island Four Bay.
Oh.
And from there they forage downriver, upriver, some people call them a black duck, but they're just a really dark bird, and they're an exceptional predator. For fish. I mean, they dive and they can pretty much eat what they want, and a lot of them. So over the bird studies, they're doing a lot of control of cormorants downriver in the estuary. The estimates there are that they're consuming 20 million smolt by the...
Wow. Really? At the 20 estuary. Million?
Yeah.
Wow.
5,000 nesting pairs. They're doing management of these species all up and down the river. We're not the only ones that are doing this kind of work. I mean, so we have, there's kind of a network of people, some coastal, some inland, that are kind of monitoring this whole avian predation issue. And so here at the district, we try to do it to increase our out-migration numbers, and they do the same in other projects along the river.
We initially had some problems with beaver up at Eniat, and I haven't heard anything. Sounds like we got that problem taken care of.
Yeah. So far, we haven't built any new parks and put fresh trees in. So maybe that's where we should stop. But we did do some trapping that winter to try to reduce some of the immediate impacts that we were having there, and then the next spring summer we. Trapped and removed, I believe it was 10 or 11, and transferred those to the Forest Service in Okanagan County, and they were releasing them in some of the really highly impacted fire areas to try to reestablish dams in those ravines so that they could quickly get soil stabilizing plants, holding. And so, and since that time, we haven't had any problems with beaver. So USDA is on call primarily. In 2015, for example, we only spent about 75% of the contract amount because some of this is on call work, and we just don't know when we'll need it or when we won't. So, but they're available.
Great, thank you.
You're welcome.
Yeah, we had problems with beaver at the BB Springs project that we did up there, similar to Antioch. But that's great that they're picking them up and transferring them, moving them.
Yeah, they're trying to do
balance.
Yeah, where they can, they're trying to relocate those animals and put them into a place where they've been maybe extirpated so that they can have a benefit instead of just removing them. So.
Commissioners?
Thank you very much, guys.
Great report.
Thank you. Thanks.
All right, thank you.
That's it for resolutions today. All right.
So,
well, I will, Mr. Chairman, I'll move acceptance of resolution 11.
Second?
That's right. There's just so many.
I
forgot. I've got a job to do here.
It's been moved and seconded. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed, say no. The motion carries.
Thank you. So we would like to bring forward the motion that we've discussed earlier today with respect to establishing a reserve fund for facilities. So you have that motion in front of you. We've left blank the amount, although I think we've discussed a couple of times here the idea of using the amount that we were over, roughly the amount that we were over in 2016 of $20 million. So at this point, that would be a staff recommendation, consistent, I think, with what we've heard from the commission as that being a good number to get started with here. So I'm going to turn it back over to you.
Mr. Chairman, I would move to put $20 million into a reserve fund for our future facility plan as a commitment from the board to the importance of what we need to do.
I didn't speak up quickly enough. I'm not going to second that right now, and I'm going to make a comment. I hesitate to do this, and I really hesitate to put a number to it until we have all five commissioners here. I just don't feel comfortable doing it with only three commissioners. I think Randy's been a part of, Commissioner Smith has been a part of our discussions, and I believe he's in favor of it. Commissioner Bowles has not. There's no rush. There's no urgency on this, right?
There is not, no.
How do you feel?
I
mean, I would support it, but I just hesitate to do it now while there are only three of us here.
My sense of it is that this is a step forward for facilities planning that has been discussed for some time. It was discussed at our last meeting, where Commissioner Smith was in attendance to the meeting. I've been told that others have spoken with Commissioner Bolts about this, with no objection on his part. I would not have a problem moving forward to at least establishing the reserve account, but perhaps not funding it until the other commissioners are able to chime in.
Yeah, I'll support it if we don't put a number, if we leave the number section blank. I'll support it, I believe, in establishing a reserve fund, but I can't support a number at this point today.
Mr. McKenna, your comments?
I've talked to both Randy and Dennis, so I know where they're at, but I think it's important to have something as important as this signified by all. So I will withdraw my motion. But I would like and edit it with I'd like to establish the fact that we are going to make a reserve. And wait until we have more in attendance to determine the amount. Can we do that?
Yes.
I could make a suggestion here. I think the motion before could easily be amended to just be motion directing staff to establish a board designated fund for the purpose of investing in a long-term facilities plan, period. And we would just pick up the rest of it at a future date.
Commissioners, is that acceptable? Mm-hmm.
You want to make that motion, Steve?
I'll make the motion as was read by Steve.
So, for the record, that's just a period after facilities?
He has a
plan? Okay.
So, I'll reread the motion. It's a motion directing staff to establish a board designated fund for the purpose of investing in the long term facilities plan.
I'll second the motion.
It's been moved and seconded. Any further discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed signify by saying no. The aye is carried. The motion is carried.
We are on to manager items, and we just have one more today. I invite Keith Truscott to come up and talk about some work that's gone on with respect to coho at both Rocky Reach and Rock Island.
Good afternoon, Commissioners. Keith Truscott, Director of Natural Resources. I invited Steve Hemstrom, a senior fisheries biologist for us, and Lance Keller, who you heard from earlier, also a senior fisheries biologist, to partake in the discussion and have the good pleasure of updating you on a recent activity with our habitat conservation plans, or HCPs, as we frequently refer to them, for both Rocky Reach and Rock Island. Last week, the HCP Coordinating Committee took some action that was very an excellent positive message towards the collaboration and teamwork and good science that goes into our agreements. If you recall, the HCPs address high levels of protection for what we call planned species, and those are spring Chinook, steelhead, sockeye, summer fall Chinook, and one we don't talk about very often, that's coho. So coho are one of the species covered under the HCP. We've been implementing programs, hatchery obligations, mitigation, from the onset of an early implementation of the HCP for some time now. In 2007, the information that was gathered to that point, and testing that was done with spring Chinook, the committee felt, and we agreed, that coho most likely survived at a level equivalent to or near that of spring Chinook and other plant species. And unless there was some concrete evidence that there was negative impacts going on with the hydro beyond what we felt was there, that they would be deemed phase three interim protection level. And phase three is the ultimate level to get to when you're testing and showing survival for juvenile fish at our projects. So we went to phase three interim level. A 10-year period of time was agreed to where we would continue our hatchery obligations. More information would be gathered about coho. And in the fall of 2017, we would come together again and assess the population and how they're performing. So last week, through the work of Steve, Lance, Aline Underwood, Catherine Willard, who had been working a year plus on this scientific analysis, an in-depth comparison of coho information compared to what we knew about spring Chinook, they were able to make a very compelling case from the science side that indeed coho are surviving equivalent to that of spring Chinook. The outcome of that was we were able to move coho to phase three, standards achieved. No longer interim, but standards achieved as it go forward. So the significance of that is it does not require the district at this point then to go out and conduct those extensive juvenile survival tests that you're all familiar with that we've done in the past. Multiple years at multiple projects for several million dollars. So the outcome I would describe it as wonderful. And it's not just the utility that came forward. Yeah, we have great scientists that put their expertise and knowledge to work, but it was also a collaborative effort, a listening audience through the coordinating committee that was open to the data and interpreted that and looked at it hard before they agreed with us. But it is the outcome that we arrived at and wanted to make you aware of it.
That's great.
Congratulations.
Yeah.
That's
a wonderful great outcome.
Thank you very much. Any questions?
Were the plant species spring Chinook, sockeye, summer and fall Chinook, and coho? Did I miss one?
Yeah.
How about
and steelhead?
That's what, yes, I thought. Steelhead. Yeah. Thanks.
Yeah.
Well, that's great.
Yeah, I can't say enough about the work that our staff did to dive into the data. And it was multiple years of pit tag data, two different species, as well as acoustic analysis, and coming up with this comparison so that it was real, it made sense, and it's now the condition we have in place. So we're in a great position right now.
That's great.
Can you tell me a little bit more about the group that reviewed the data?
Yeah, I will actually let Lance respond to that, because I am the messenger on this piece, and the people I mentioned earlier are the ones that did the work, and I will certainly let Lance take the lead on that one, and Steve can fill in as well.
Yeah, so the signatories to the HCP are obviously Chelan PUD, as well as State Department of Fish and Wildlife, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, NOAA/NIMS. The two are kind of interchangeable. And then we also have signatories in the Colville Confederate Tribe and the Yakima Nation Tribe. So those are the people that sit around, and they have representatives that are essentially at the coordinating committee meetings that we presented. Like Keith mentioned, we started assembling this data about a year ago, but we really started engaging them, that group, in talks in September. And those were monthly talks at every meeting, you know, kind of trying to make sure everyone was comfortable with this methodology that we were performing, and everyone could actually pull out a calculator and get to the same result we have. That's really important. It really is a transparent agreement that we can really stand on as a solid foundation for that phase 3 standard for coho. So does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you very much.
So we still have to measure and show that we're achieving the standards, but by being phase 3, not interim, but phase 3, I forget what you called it, Keith.
Yeah, so it's the permanent.
Achieved,
yeah, phase 3 standards.
So we
achieved.
Still have to measure, but just not nearly as much measurement and pit tagging and so forth.
Right. So what will happen is, in your earlier conversation, you talked about the check-in date, right? Mm-hmm. So at both Rocky Beach and Rock Island in 2020 and 2021, you will do a check-in study to make sure that we're still having those levels of protection at the project for juvenile fish. And the coordinating committee has the obligation to select the species that will be used in that test. So most likely, you know, we'll see the steelhead or spring Chinook study that will go forward. And all those plant species then that come under that envelope of how did you perform under that one study will be included in that assessment. You don't need to study each individual species. You'll do, you know, one species, one study, and hopefully reach that standard, and then you'll go for another 10 years.
What if you don't reach that? Sorry, but I was just thinking, what if you don't reach that standard? Then you are on a new and more involved plan to achieve it in the next 10 year. Do they then prescribe a plan for you? How does that work?
Yeah, so there's a process in place if it happened that way. So there are stepwise processes you go through then to go back and retest the second year, and then you'll get an average from that for your survival. And if necessary, you could do a third year of study. Kind of a restart on an individual species to get you there.
So there's time and there's a process.
There is.
That we can go through.
Very much so.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Thank you.
Yeah.
Is this the last time we're going to have Keith here presenting to us?
I think it might be.
I think it is.
We can always set a special meeting between now and the end of the week.
Good.
The question is whether he'd show up or not.
Yeah.
Carlo, you want to come up?
You guys can slide back here.
Thank you, Lance.
I don't know if you've met Carla Trescott. Why don't you introduce your wife, if you would?
She can introduce herself.
I'm Carla Trescott. It's better half.
much better half.
Much better girl.
We just wanted to take a moment to acknowledge that at the end of this week, these two individuals who've been exceptional PUD employees, Carla part of just an key component of the conservation department. Keith has run natural resources for a number of years. They're going to walk out of here together in retirement and after almost 70 years collectively. Wow. They've just done so much good for this district, and they're going to be sorely missed.
Thank you, Jeff. I'll just keep it really short. I just want to say how fortunate we feel to have had such a wonderful career at the utility, and so many challenges faced, and we've been successful on many of them. We've learned from some that we could do better in some instances, and that's all part of the process as well. I can't say enough about the people that work here. That is the part that Carla and I will miss the most. We have a long list of things to go out and take on, but the folks that work at the utility are exceptional, and their heart and soul and their desire to perform and do the things that are right for the utility and our customer owners in this region are amazing, and they are really what make the utility what it is today. Thank you very much. You know, we were talking about this week. We've worked for seven general managers and quite a different makeup of board over the time, and without a doubt, beyond anything, it all starts at that level. And the successes we talked about today took a lot of courage from general managers and board to support and move forward. And you, as a board, exhibit those same traits. And I know that will be what we see going forward. It's just really been good. And it's good for the board and GMs to hear that as well, because that's where it starts. Yeah, so thanks. Well,
thank you. Mr. Conger.
You can't get away yet. I haven't worked with Carla, but I have worked with Keith in a number of different ways, but primarily with the boat club at Lake Chelan, the boating club at Lake Chelan. And that is a long, difficult, I guess you might say controversial, the whole setup and how the boathouse got where it is, or not the boathouse, the clubhouse, and where it came from and what promises were made. All of that was really, really difficult to sort through. And I watched Keith work with this group, and they do a lot of good for the community, for boating in general, and they want to stay where they are. And Keith, with the support of the PUD folks behind him, has just done an amazing job. I mean, I watch him work with these folks and try to, we have to, set a line in the sand somewhere with the group, and it's complicated. But anyway, I have just been amazed. I am so impressed with how, sorry I'm embarrassing you, but how Keith has worked with this group, and we've been able to get to a place where it works, for them and works for us and meets our obligations. And so I've learned a lot. I've loved watching you. I've learned a lot. And then I have one more story about Keith. This one just really blew me away. It was years ago. We were flying back to D.C. for meetings, and Keith is taller than I am. Thin, but he's taller than I am. And I was in my aisle seat. I always sit in the aisle seat so I can stretch my legs off. And a family got on the airplane, and I think they had two or three young children. And I don't know if you even remember this, Keith, but the mom wanted to sit by the more difficult young child, who was... I forget how it all worked. But anyway, Keith offered to give up his seat in the aisle and sit in the middle seat, probably between two kids, for a six-hour ride. And I thought, wow, that is amazing, because I never want to have to sit in that middle seat. So that showed me what kind of a good guy Keith Truscott is. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Yep. Thank you.
I was wondering if it wasn't Keith's mom traveling and Keith was the difficult child.
I doubt if he was ever a difficult child.
Well, we were able to take care of manager items and commission items this morning.
We do, if you would like, we do have, I understand Mike Coleman may have an update for you on what's going on with the fiber rebuild. But we actually... We had both two things going on. We had a problem in Leavenworth over the weekend, and also the fire up at Horse Lake Road. Mike can do something for us here.
So we did have two incidents over the weekend. On Saturday afternoon during a windstorm, there was some sheet steel that came off of a roof and took out a 96 pair of cable. We had about 80 people out. Due to the weather and the lack of crew availability, it was Sunday morning before they started, and I chose to go out Sunday and visit them and just offer them some encouragement. This is Corey Sampson that's doing the splicing on one end of the cable. Is it going to go? That's a successful splice. I just had to throw that in there. You'll see that it has a loss of 0.02 dB, which is a really, really good splice. The tin that did the damage, this is part of it. They ended up having to tie it to a fence post with a rope because it was continuing to blow around. And what it did was it damaged the cable, cut part of it, and so we had to replace about a 500-foot section. This is Tony Valentine, who was on the other end of the 500-foot section. So they had to do 96 splices on each end of the cable, and they had it back mid-afternoon on Sunday. I don't have pictures for the rest of it. On the way to Leavenworth, I passed three fire engines headed towards Wenatchee, and I was wondering what's going on. And so when I came back from Leavenworth, I found out about the fire. We lost three 96-pair cables, one backbone cable, two distribution cables. They did not burn. They were cut, probably for access by the firefighters. They probably would have burned anyway, so same difference. They started on that this morning, and they're prioritizing the backbone cable. It has a lot of business circuits in it, circuits to hospitals, banks, etc. The other two cables, the distribution cables, are feeding customers from that western node, and they will be second priority, but they should be back in service tonight. Three 96-pair cables, so 288 strands spliced on each end of the repair, so they have to do 576 splices individually. And they will finish that up tomorrow morning sometime. So all in all, it was an exciting weekend. We did have one little malfunction. On the backbone cable, it should have automatically rerouted to an alternate facility. Everything rerouted except for the three DS1s, which had a lot of the business circuits. So we're still looking at the root cause. We have an agreement with Localtel that we will identify the root cause, determine how it does not happen again, and then sometime in the near future, we will actually conduct some failover tests to verify the working of that logic. So that's it.
Wow.
That's a lot of splices.
It is. So, yeah. I always have to remind everybody that, like, some of the electrical facilities were cut for that access also. For them to repair a conductor, it takes 2 minutes and a butt splice. And so a couple of connectors, a neutral, and 6 minutes, and they're back in business. And we're still there 10 hours later splicing. So,
wow. Any questions?
No, but this... I'm sure this probably isn't a very good comparison, but we have this up at Echo Valley Ski Hill. We have a really old Pommalift, and it's on a spliced metal cable. Actually, the Pommalift came from Squilchuck State Park. It was old when it was there. And that has to be spliced every now and then. And that apparently is a lost art. There are not very many people around who know how to do that anymore. And the last time we did it, we had a short section of that cable that needed to be spliced, and the way it has to be done, you have to have people strung out 70 feet down the cable and another 10 people strung out 70 feet up the cable, and then they have to all do something in unison. It's the craziest thing I've ever seen. It's tough, but maybe not as tough as splicing, probably not as tough as splicing fiber.
Splicing copper is cumbersome. I will have to tell you that it doesn't even compare to fiber.
Bet. Yeah. Thank you, Mike.
Mike, before you run off,
I just want to let you know I really appreciated that report this morning on the proof of concept for wireless. That was incredibly beneficial to help me in my thinking, because I would have thought just the opposite. That, and to have that delineated out and we have proof on that, and I just thought it was an exceptional report.
I appreciate knowing that. I know that there's always sensitivity to the length of our presentations, and it's sometimes a really hard judgment call as to how much of the education is needed to get to the conclusion, and we were trying to find mm-hmm. a balance in that one. I think here at the PUD we deal with a lot of very complex subjects, and so I know that on this side of the table, not only I, but a lot of other folks look at it and try to hit the right combination to convey the right information to the board.
Team did a great job. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mike.
I think we're ready to get to commission travel. You're ready?
Okay. Lisa?
Thanks, Lisa.
All the way around. Stuck. I'm Lisa Sanders, admin and finance. Here to go over your future travel arrangements. This month's Waputa meetings are all set. Hotels. I just need Commissioner Congdon's registration. Do you have that in your I left one in your office.
You know what? It's right here. I'll pass it around.
Thank you. Yeah. Please double check your hotel dates and make sure that they're correct. Thank you.
You're
mid-April the 14th, we need to double check for any cancellations for Sun River, or we'll lose our deposit if we don't cancel by then. I have kept Commissioner Bowles hotel for now. I have one for Commissioner Congdon. I canceled Commissioner Arsenault, McKenna, and Smith. But Janet at NWPPA, she had speakers who hadn't made hotel reservations yet, so rather than canceling, I gave her these rooms.
Mm-hmm.
So I have this information on here, just I'm working with her as she reassigns those rooms that we get our deposits back and they don't go towards their speakers balance.
Is someone going to speak with Dennis? And I doubt if Dennis will be able to go, but when do you need to, is it a 24-hour cancellation or 48 hours?
No, it's this April 14th.
Oh, you said that. You did. So we'll need
to. I spoke to Commissioner Smith, and he wanted to wait a little bit.
Okay.
So I'll wait till closer
okay.
to that date.
Good.
Before we decide what we want to do with that. Then, Sheila, are you confirming up your dates for Steve? Okay, so I think everything's all set for that otherwise. June APPA, I have rooms held. Commissioner Congdon let me know that she won't be attending.
I will be attending the July 19th Waputa meeting.
July 19th?
Yes.
Thank you.
That's the one on Ocean Shores or out on the coast?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
I have it down and I'll be attending as well, Lisa.
And I will be.
Yeah.
Ocean Shores says right there.
Have you seen anything yet about room block? I looked last week. I didn't see anything.
I haven't seen anything.
Okay. I just thought you might get information before I do sometimes.
And I can look forward to the annual conference for Waputa in December and say that I will be there.
Yep. Okay. Davenport. Okay. Is there anything else you'd like me to update or confirm?
I won't be attending Energy Northwest Forum in October. You can cross me out.
Okay.
And don't know, November, I'm undecided yet on that.
Okay.
But I will be at the annual conference, I think.
Okay. Is there anything else I can help with?
No, but this is great. This is a good process.
Thank
you. It's very helpful. Yep. Thank you.
It helps me too. Okay. Thank you.
Thanks, Lisa.
Thank you, Lisa.
You're welcome.
So in terms of our delegation for action items, we have two from the last meeting, the life cycle analysis of the underground versus above ground, why the cost differential between that. So we've actually been doing a bunch of work on that to go back and look at all the different studies, and there's just a lot of information there. So we're pretty far along in that. We'll have something by the next meeting for you on that. So we've been not only looking at our own studies, but we've been looking at other utility studies and gathering just a lot of information about it. And then you had also asked that we make sure that the opt-out option is included in the AMI material. And as you heard earlier today, it's included in the FAQs mm-hmm. that are going out with that. So it'll be in writing from us. And that's it.
Okay.
Have
delegation for today.
Yeah, I had one. Now I'm looking for it. Oh, I know. I'm sorry. So on the motion, we'll come back to you once we have Commissioner Smith and Commissioner Bowles back to come back with a proposed number to take to put into the financial reserves for facilities planning. That was the only one I had. Did I miss anything?
Right. I think that was it.
Yeah.
No additional public comment. Matters of general business. And we have need for an executive session today to discuss with legal counsel agency enforcement actions, litigation, potential litigation to which the district or its board is or likely to become a party, and or legal risks as authorized by RCW 42.30.1101I. How long will we need?
I was thinking 30 minutes.
30 minutes. Do we need a break?
Can we take a 5 or whatever?
5 minute break? Let's take a 5 minute break and we'll be back here at 2:00. How's that?
Good.
Okay. Yes. We're coming out of executive session. It is April 3rd, 2017. No decisions were made, no votes were taken. Is there any additional business to come before the commission? Hearing none, we stand adjourned.